Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Today we're going to talk about what the potential impact of going off the so-called federal fiscal cliff would mean for the state of New Mexico. Negotiations between President Obama and Republican leaders so far are focusing mainly on whether to raise income tax rates for the wealthy, how much to cut from entitlement programs like Medicare, and how to handle the nation's deficit. We do welcome your calls and comments this morning. The local number here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. The toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can also email callinshow@kunm.org, and you can post your comments online at kunm.org. And those comments, of course, are available to anyone using our website. Joining us this morning to discuss this, we have Jerry Bradley from New Mexico Voices for Children, Paul Gessing with the Rio Grande Foundation, and also Chris Wellman with the National Priorities Project. Good morning to you all.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing? I know we have you by phone, and I wanted to go to you first and ask you to give a brief definition of what exactly the fiscal cliff is.
Well, it's primarily two major policy changes. One is the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts, and the second is a series of automatic across-the-board spending cuts known as sequestration that are a result of a budget deal that President Obama and Congress enacted last year. And taken between the two, we could see a significant increase in individual income taxes and also some fairly dramatic spending cuts to a bunch of discretionary federal programs.
So from your perspective, Chris, can you explain what you see as the strategy behind this agreement that was reached between the president and Congress to set up this situation that we're in now?
Well, part of it had to do with last year. Periodically, we have to increase the federal debt ceiling, the amount that the federal government can borrow. There's limits set on the debt, the amount of debt we can have that are set by statute. And periodically, since we continue to borrow and run deficits, we have to raise that. And as part of the negotiations, Republican leaders on Capitol Hill insisted that we come up with something called the Budget Control Act, which called for about $2.4 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years. And failure to hit that target or a portion of that target would result in these automatic spending cuts. And the reason that the spending cuts were put into place was not so much to actually have them enacted, but they were considered to be so draconian in nature that they were viewed as sort of a gun at the head of our elected officials to come up with a reasonable deficit reduction package. But political gridlock being what it was, we didn't see that result, and so now we have this potential automatic across-the-board cuts of about $1.2 trillion over the next decade.
So we have many of our listeners may be familiar with the Bush-era tax cuts that have been discussed pretty widely, and the term sequestration has been used pretty regularly, but I'm wondering if you could go into a little more detail about what exactly sequestration is.
Well, sequestration is the result of legislation that was originally enacted back in the 1980s, known as the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act, and it's basically what it says in the simplest terms is if you fail to hit certain deficit targets, you being Congress, we will enact automatic spending cuts across the board that will bring the federal budget in line with these spending targets. And the laws have been on the books, again, as I said, for over a couple of decades, but they really haven't been impacted, mainly because Congress has either waived them or abided by them and in very small ways. But they were sort of revived as the mechanism to force negotiations between the sort of belligerent parties, the Democrats and Republicans in Washington, last summer. And as I said, there was no expectation that this would actually happen. There was every belief that Congress would be able to come up with a package that the White House could live with. But in the throes of the election year, that didn't come to fruition. So these automatic cuts, which are focused on what's known as the discretionary budget, they leave out entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and some other benefit programs. But they, you know, they would focus cuts on things like the military and a bunch of domestic programs related to education, et cetera, which could have a fairly significant impact on a number of these programs.
And this sequestration would mean that, and I was, you know, the definition of sequestration is that the Treasury doesn't release the funds. Right, it is sequestered by the Treasury. Right?
What they say is, you know, your budget is going. You being the federal agency, your budget is going to be reduced by this amount. And
across the board, right?
It's across the board, and that's one of the things that's problematic about it. I mean, I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, cutting government spending right now is going to be a component of any program to do deficit reduction. But what sequestration does is it takes out of the hands of Congress and federal administrators the ability to select one program over another, and it just sort of takes a chop right off the top, which, you know, to our mind is really not good government, because it doesn't allow you to weigh the relative merits of the programs that are facing potential cuts.
Thanks, Chris, for setting that up for us. I'd like to go now to you, Jerry Bradley, with New Mexico Voices for Children. As you see it, what are some of the top concerns that your organization has about the impact of the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts and the implementation of sequestration if there is no deal made in Congress and with the president?
Well, New Mexico Voices for Children released a report last month that goes through the possible impacts of the sequestration on New Mexico. That said, New Mexico media has focused very much on the defense cuts, and the defense cuts could range up to $500 million next year, so that's significant. New Mexico Voices wanted to focus on the non-defense cuts that could result from sequestration. And according to a report from Senator Harkin's office, which breaks down the sequestration impact by state, New Mexico could lose about $41 million in the non-defense funding next year, and that most of that is in education.
And what kind of education funding are we talking about here?
Mostly Title I funding for poverty schools, where there's very high proportions of reduced or free school lunches. So that would impact those. The other impacts would be in health and human services and in training programs. So that would be 41 million, probably 2,000 jobs or so affected. And, you know, just to pull back a little bit, New Mexico's economy has yet to recover from the Great Recession. New Mexico is, according to the latest data from last month, is still losing 6,000 jobs over the year. So New Mexico is not in good shape to absorb these punishing cuts, both in defense and non-defense programs.
I'd like to go now to you, Paul, with the Rio Grande Foundation. From your organization's perspective, what are your largest concerns with the impacts that going over the fiscal cliff, the so-called fiscal cliff, would have on the state?
Well, it's important to take a step back and really analyze the size of the relative quote-unquote cuts versus the tax increases. And yes, there are reductions in certain programs, and we're not a huge fan of the way sequestration came about, but it's not actually reducing net federal spending. A lot of this is federal spending gobbledygook, which is we're reducing the increase that they expect to get next year. If you look at a chart, and Veronique DeRougie of the Mercatus Center has a great chart online showing that even with this sequestration in place, you're not going to see net actual overall federal spending cuts. The big concern is obviously that the tax increases are very massive. Over the next decade, it's going to be multiples of trillions of dollars relative to the 1.2 that is potentially going to be cut over that time. The tax increases.
And when you say
really
tax increases, you mean renewing Bush era tax cuts either in their entirety or for part of the population.
Right. Well, the debate is underway in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What, if any, of those tax increases or tax cuts to renew or not renew? It doesn't look like all of them will be renewed. Obama is certainly pushing for the ones on high earners to be put in place again. So those are concerns, and a lot of folks, including us, are concerned that that massive increase combined with some renewed spending restraint through the sequestration process is really going to set the national economy and specifically New Mexico's economy, because of our over-reliance on Washington spending within our borders, back. It's going to be very challenging.
Well, so if sequestration, from your perspective, does not result in a decrease in federal spending, then does that mean that your perspective is that sequestration wouldn't hurt New Mexico?
Well, it will hurt the discretionary programs that we benefit from, but the massive growth of those entitlement programs is going to overcome and overwhelm.
And by entitlement, we're talking
Medicare and Social Security. So that's really overwhelming any of these cuts. Discretionary programs, the military being by far and away the biggest, are no longer really driving the budget picture in Washington. It's Medicare and Social Security redistribution programs. And that's why the Republicans in Congress are really focusing a lot of their attention on trying to reform those and make them more sustainable, because we have Medicare facing $36 trillion unfunded liability, and Social Security is facing $8.6 trillion unfunded liability. These programs are unsustainable in the long term, and they need to be addressed. That's not to say that they're the only place to save money. Certainly the military is another area, and the discretionary spending are other areas to do that. But if you're going to balance the budget, we're borrowing a third of the money that we spend as the federal government every year right now, $1.1 trillion out of a $3.6 trillion budget. It's unsustainable, so we do need to cut. And there's going to be some pain involved. There's no doubt about it.
So, Chris, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Part of what I've been trying to conceptualize, thinking about this issue and these negotiations, is a scale that has more than two sides. So, or like a mobile in a way that is suspended in the air, and each piece is weighted and balanced, and the attempt is try to get everything to balance. And but there's more than two sides. There's multiple kind of pieces in this balancing project. And at least according to the statement that President Obama made this week, he kind of implied in his statement that the question of how to come to a deal rests on how this balance is calculated for the different parts. And he specifically said, should the middle class Americans and students be expected to pay the majority of the cost of creating this balance? Or, you know, can you talk a little bit about who is responsible for what parts of this balance and how big they are compared to each other?
Well, I think Paul, in his previous statement, you know, made a really good point, which is that, you know, what's driving deficits in the long run is not the discretionary portion. It's the major entitlement programs. What's problematic about the way sequestration, and just to take a step back, you know, when we talked about earlier about the Budget Control Act, their mandate was to come up with $2.4 trillion in deficit reduction. And there are several ways to reduce the deficit. One is to cut spending, but the other is to increase revenues. And what sequestration does is it focuses all of this quote-unquote deficit reduction on cutting spending. So it sort of falls, and because you exempt the major entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, from those cuts, and that's not entirely accurate, but it's generally true. You're focusing all of your attention on this very narrow portion of the federal budget, this one-third that is the discretionary spending. So when you talk about deficit reduction, what the president is talking about is what they're referring to in Washington as some sort of grand bargain, where you look at the federal budget across the board and you talk about entitlement reform and you talk about new revenues and you talk about cutting spending, as opposed to what sequestration does, which is focus all the attention right on that small portion of it that is spending. And I think that both, you know, Republicans and Democrats in Washington would rather have the grand bargain, this idea where we put everything on the table and discuss it and come up with a plan. But right now the clock is ticking on that other portion, and that's the part that they have to address in the short term, lest we lose funding for the programs that Jerry was talking about earlier. So it's really sort of a two-tiered discussion. It's what are we going to do in the short term, and then how do we get to this broader discussion about deficit reduction?
Chris Wellman is with the National Priorities Project. Paul Gessing is with the Rio Grande Foundation, and Jerry Bradley is with New Mexico Voices for Children. This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and we are taking your calls this morning on the potential impacts of going over the so-called fiscal cliff here in New Mexico. The local number to call is 277-5866. The toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can email callinshow@kunm.org, and you can also post your comments online at kunm.org. Let's go now to the phones. Glenn in Hemis Springs. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the program, and thanks to Jerry Bradley for being a responsible New Mexican for 30-some years. I got an email from National Memo a month or more ago. It said that those of us who have savings, IRAs, 401ks, are really going to take a hit the end of this month would this whole fiscal cliff mess not be resolved. I'm thinking back to Michael Moore suggesting that we put our money in credit unions, and I'm wondering what your panel would suggest on that. And then finally, I would like to invite the wealthy folks in Santa Fe to call into this show and express the opinion of staying with the Bush advantage for the wealthy, or doing what Warren Buffett says and letting the folks earning more than $250,000 being taxed more. Thank you.
Glenn, I'm gonna pause on part of your question, because I think that your question about what to do with an IRA might be more accurately targeted towards a certified financial planner. That's the kind of person I'm going to recommend that you that you contact that person, because my panel hasn't been put together to give that kind of advice. I will come back to that point. I think I would like to hear from our listeners as to what do you think about the expiring Bush tax cuts, and what would you like to see happen with those? And we are going to go to a bit more detailed conversation towards the end of the hour about some of the proposals from both sides of the aisle in Washington, and what those proposals might mean from New Mexico. But we'll stick with impacts of the fiscal cliff for New Mexico right now. Let's go to Barbara in Albuquerque.
Yes, I have a question for Paul Gessing, and I am curious about all the job losses that we have had during the years of the Bush tax cuts, while corporate profits have been growing enormously in every sector, especially including the banks. But where are the jobs that these job creators were making? We had massive losses of jobs during the Bush years, and we've had some uptick in jobs since Obama came into office. But where are those jobs, those job creators that we're protecting with this tax cut we're supposed to be making?
Paul?
Well, I'm not here to defend President Bush's record. I will defend the tax cuts, although I think even they were misimplemented based on this temporary 10-year window that they went with originally. But George W. Bush was a very big spender, let spending get out of control. Regulations also went out of control, and he was unable to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, along with Congress, of course. Congress is part of this whole equation, but much of that time it was controlled by Republicans, and they failed to restrain and reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So Bush's tax cuts may be worth keeping in the place. That's not to say that it should be the hill that Republicans die on in terms of this whole discussion. If they can get some real reforms to entitlements, real reforms to entitlements. It has to be emphasized that this doesn't get lost in the future as a "we'll promise to do this" kind of thing. But if we actually get these reforms, the Bush tax cuts could be allowed to expire. So I think the economy would have been worse without the Bush tax cuts, but he did a lot of other things that were not so great for the economy.
Jerry, what are your thoughts on the Bush-era tax cuts?
Well, the Bush-era tax cuts took place, and also the failure to pay for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, all were irresponsible. You know, I think when there's a failure to pay for a war, it probably means that the administration in power at that time senses a lack of public support for that war. I think that happened in the Vietnam War, and it happened in the wars that George W. Bush embarked on. So the combination of the Bush tax cuts and the wars led us in part to where we are now. Repealing the Bush tax cuts for the top 2% would yield about $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions. The Economic Policy Institute has a very interesting report out that shows that repealing the Bush-era tax cuts on the top 2% and enacting several stimulus programs, including extending unemployment compensation, aid to state governments, investment in infrastructure, and investment in teachers and schools, could lead to a net increase in employment, and at the same time reducing the deficit.
Jerry, just to clarify, is that $1.2 trillion over 10 years?
Yes, thank you, Paul. It's $1.2 trillion over the 2013 to 2022 period. So $1.2 trillion could half of that could be used for various methods of stimulating the economy. And, you know, from my perspective, the most important thing to realize is that in some ways we're having just the wrong conversation. And the conversation that we're having about how to reduce the deficit, how to reduce the debt, is the wrong conversation, because the unemployment rate is still around 8%. We're adding jobs at a fairly anemic rate. We're expecting only 90,000 jobs in the federal report that comes out on employment tomorrow. So it's the context that we should be talking about is how do we add jobs. What are the methods that we can add jobs and bring the unemployment rate down to some rational level?
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. Jerry Bradley is with New Mexico Voices for Children. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with your calls about the impact of the fiscal cliff here in New Mexico. This is KUNM.
Hitchcock will open in theaters December 14th, but KUNM is giving away 25 pair of VIP tickets to an advanced screening on Wednesday, December 12th, 7 p.m. at Century Downtown, Albuquerque, in the hope that you will help power us over the last stretch of our goal for 2012. We'll draw the 25 winners at 5 p.m. on Monday, December 10th. Just go to KUNM.org and click on the link to support the station and or register for the tickets. 25 winners picked December 10th.
Support for KUNM comes from the not-for-profit New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where members earn rewards for their relationship, checking, credit cards, auto loans, and mortgages. Details and calculator on member rewards at nmefcu.org.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. It's about 8:27 here on this Thursday morning. We are asking for your calls and comments this morning on the impact of the fiscal cliff. If we were to go over that cliff, if no deal is struck between members of Congress and the president, what would that mean for New Mexico? The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. 5866. Paul Gessing from the Rio Grande Foundation is here in the studio with us. We also have Chris Hellman from the National Priorities Project joining us this morning, and Jerry Bradley is with New Mexico Voices for Children. Let's now go to the phones. Linda in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. Thank you for taking this call. I want to address my comments to the disingenuous and dishonest representation of Social Security being thrown into this mix. Everybody from Ronald Reagan to Bernie Sanders understands that if you're going to talk so-called entitlement, Social Security is not part of that. It's totally funded by the people that pay into it. And if you get to a place where there are insufficient funds, it's very simple, a tiny little act to raise the cap. Right now, people with make a lot of money are cut off much earlier, and as we all know, not only do elected officials not pay Social Security because they're in the government retirement system, but neither do people with great wealth. Their money comes from dividends, capital gains, and that sort of thing, and earned income is what Social Security is derived from. So I think the continued attack on Social Security, which is the safety net for millions and millions of Americans, is dishonest and should be removed, and people ought to quit talking about it. And if they talk about it, they ought to know what they're talking about. So thank you, Elaine, and happy holidays. Bye.
Thanks, Linda. Paul, did you have a response to her?
Sure, I'd love to respond to that. You know, economists left, right, and center will put Social Security appropriately in there as an entitlement. And, you know, I just got to say it's not being paid for by the people who are receiving it. It's being paid for by current generations of workers are paying the retirement costs of those who are currently retired. It's a pay-as-you-go system. And the benefits received have no relation to, well, very little relation to what you pay into it in terms of what you did over your career. The first lady who received Social Security paid in something like $40 and got multiple thousands of dollars in payouts.
I want to go now to Chris Hellman with the National Priorities Project. And as we're talking, I'm getting this picture in my mind of the sequestration plan that was passed earlier was an attempt to force, I mean, would you characterize it as an attempt to force conversation about cutting things like Medicare and Social Security in a way that most lawmakers and presidents are generally unwilling to do by threatening the automatic cuts to the discretionary budget?
Well, I don't know if it was, you know, specifically intended to force that discussion, but it was intended to force a broad discussion about, you know, the role of federal government and how to maintain these programs moving forward. And I want to thank Paul for his statement on Social Security, because there's, you know, the caller said, understand what you know about Social Security. There's a lot of misinformation about the way that program works. It's a question we get repeatedly about why it's a component of the discussion about the federal budget, and it's an important discussion to have. So, but clearly, whether it was targeting Social Security and Medicare, which, as you point out, are sort of political third rails, sequestration was absolutely intended to force people to the negotiating table to make some tough choices, be it about entitlement programs or taxation or cutting federal spending.
Jerry, did you have thoughts on this conversation about Social Security and the role that the government plays with that particular program and sequestration?
Well, the caller alluded to the cap on wages that are taxed under the Social Security program. And I would also like to say that...
What is that cap?
I'm sorry, the cap is $110,000 in 2012.
Meaning that people who make more than $110,000 a year do not pay Social Security on any income that they make above that amount, correct?
That's right. The payroll taxes are not paid on income above $110,000. And the caller, I think, correctly alluded to the fact that that cap could be raised. It could be raised a lot. And then Social Security would not have any problem. You know, it's also important to realize with Social Security that the benefits could be paid, full benefits could be paid up to 2037. And at that point, 80% of benefits could be paid. And that's without any changes to that program at all. But this, you know, if having a discussion on the deficit and the debt during a time of national employment recession is a bad idea. It's especially bad idea to be pulling Social Security into the conversation. Social Security is not the problem. It doesn't contribute to the debt or to the deficit. And with some fairly minor tinkering, Social Security would be solvent toward the end of this century. So it's kind of a big red herring put in the middle of the conversation.
We've gotten a comment from Coral. She says that she thinks fiscal cliff is a negative term. She says she's 61 and she hasn't seen anything like these types of consequences last more than 10 years. Thoughts on that going over the fiscal cliff might not have as big of an impact as we're talking about here.
The Economic Policy Institute is referring to this particular manufactured crisis as the fiscal obstacle course, and that I think is the same as Chris is saying. There are a whole lot of different aspects to this. For us, the most important aspect is ending the Bush tax cuts on the highest 2% of earners. On top of that, you know, if we must have this conversation about deficits and debts, what's important is to stabilize the national debt as a proportion of GDP, and ending the Bush tax cuts and some fairly minor changes to the Medicare program would get us to 70% of GDP as a proportion of the national debt.
Paul, your thoughts on that length of repercussions if we do go off the fiscal cliff?
Well, I do think there is a bit of much ado about nothing about a lot of this, especially the spending cuts. The spending cuts are relatively minimal. I do think the tax increases could be an immediate problem for the economy. I think over time we'll adjust. The problems are that we've seen the regulatory, the uncertainty, Obamacare, a lot of these other taxes and regulations have come in over time. But in terms of spending cuts, Bill Clinton left office with a 4.2% unemployment rate, and the federal government consumed only 18.2% of the overall economy. Today, due to, in part, Jerry's preferred stimulative policies, the federal government consumes 24% of the economy. So we've had the federal government spending more and more and more money. And I would argue that is the reason that we face the economic problems. One of the biggest reasons is that the government's taking more and more out of the economy and using it for its own purposes, which are not nearly as beneficial as the free market aspect was. And, you know, we saw how that economy was very strong in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Jerry, your response?
Well, maybe Paul would be comfortable with going back to the tax structure of the Clinton years, which is a whole lot more progressive than the tax structure that we have now.
But if we go back to the spending as well, I would take that deal in a heartbeat.
The other thing I would say is when you're looking at stress on the economy, is there really stress on the economy? And that would show up in the bond market. It would show up in the rate that the federal government has to pay on its borrowing. And Bill Clinton once said that he would like to be reincarnated as the bond market because it's all powerful. But the rate that the federal government has to pay on its 10-year bond is 1.6%. That does, that tells you that very low rate on borrowing tells you that there isn't a whole lot of stress on the economy, that the bond market is fairly sanguine about the prospects, and that perhaps some of the hysteria is very much overdone.
Let's go back to the phones. You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show, and let's hear from Roberta in Corrales. Good morning, Roberta. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was a toddler when the banks closed in 27, and After that, our family learned that you don't spend what you don't have. And this is what part of the problem is, that people just keep spending, 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 borrowing, 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 and they don't have the money to pay for it. I have taught school for 22 and a half years in the public schools of Albuquerque, and they have been at the bottom of the list forever. And they're still at the bottom of the list because there isn't enough money that's available to help kids learn. We just think that we have to pour information into their heads and they'll get it. That isn't how children learn. And I have paid into Social Security since I was 16 and had my first job, clerking in a grocery store. So I paid into Social Security until I retired from teaching. And I am distressed by the fact that the educational retirement fund for my retirement that I paid into all the time I was teaching was mismanaged, and so was Social Security mismanaged by all of the investments that was done through the hedge funds. And consequently, the money just went down the drain when that went down the drain. And I would like to know how many people know anything about the American Legislative Exchange Council, called ALEC, A-L-E-C, the acronym ALEC. I think that's something that people need to learn about.
That sounds like a great topic for a future call-in show, Roberta.
No, I know, but that is where all of the legislation is happening. It doesn't matter what Congress, what the president wants to do, what these organizations want to do to stabilize the finances. Nothing can happen because the secret organization is boilerplating the laws, state by state by state by state.
Roberta, thanks so much for your call this morning. I have a bank of full phone calls, but I am going to take your question I'm going to put it in my list of topics for future call-in shows so that we can get some answers to some of your questions. I do want to take another caller, though. Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. My comment is based on easing the impact of the fiscal cliff. We have revenue asset that comes into the state from oil and gas. However, that revenue is only 20% royalty. What we need to do is reverse that to 100% on the state level. That would create jobs. We would bring refineries into the state and create more jobs. We would be getting assets of 100% instead of 20%. So that's a big plus. I know Paul would disagree with this because the mentality of the association is to reduce government, but these jobs that will be created with 100% of our refineries and our oil and gas would be state jobs. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill. My understanding about those royalties, that's the state that sets those, correct?
That is.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep us on our federal budget talk here, since we're talking about the fiscal cliff and sequestration and the impact of whether or not the Bush era tax cuts are renewed as a whole or in part. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and Chris Hellman is on the line from the National Priorities Project. And I wanted to come back to you, Chris, and to follow up with you. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the solutions might be, as far as we've seen from the Republicans and from the Democrats? You don't have to go into numbers so much as kind of like which parts of this budget that we've been talking about, which parts of the mobile are going to be allowed to get heavier and fuller, and which ones are going to be cut so that they don't weigh as much.
It's a great question, and it goes back to the comment I made earlier about there are a couple of tiers of how this discussion is going to happen. The most immediate thing in the minds of Congress right now is how to deal with the the tax cut, automatic spending cut balance. And there are a number of ways they could go about doing this. The president has been pushing, and you know, if you've read any newspaper anywhere, you know what the stumbling block is. The Republicans, particularly in the House, don't want to see individual income tax rates return to the Clinton era levels, and the president wants to see that happen for just the top 2% of earners, and retain the current level of taxation for pretty much everybody else. And
which means, can I restate that really quickly? Because I think this is something that I've struggled to wrap my brain around also. But the issue is, the Republicans are saying we want to see all of the tax cuts expire for everyone, whereas
they want to see them continued.
They want to see them all retained.
I'm sorry. Continued. Thank you. I'm going to confuse myself. You just keep talking, Chris.
So anyhow, as you point out, they want the position, particularly of House Republicans and Speaker Boehner, is that they want to see all the tax cuts for all levels of wage earners extended moving forward. I think they'd be happy to see it done into perpetuity, and I think that was something Paul was arguing for a little bit earlier, but I suspect that it'll be some sort of temporary deal. And then the question is, you know, the president has made his line in the sand. I don't want to see the tax cuts extended for the top 2% of earners. The Republicans are saying we really can't live with that. It's going to have to work for all of them. And then I think that there is agreement that on both sides that some form of spending reduction is in order with regard to domestic programs and the military. And then there's also some, you know, consensus around the idea of entitlement reform. What that would look like, is anybody's guess at this point. But I think a couple of the simple fixes, and Jerry alluded to this earlier, was the raising or the elimination of the cap on earnings under Social Security. I happen to think that that's the very definition of a regressive tax, and I think that that's one that's very hard to argue for. But whether or not that discussion will even occur over the next 4 or 5 weeks, I think is a dubious proposition at best, because Congress is really focused now on this issue of spending and taxation, and not really the idea of entitlement programs.
Let's take another call. Romeo in Albuquerque. Good morning, Romeo. You're on the air.
Good morning. My comment is, you know, it's funny how people keep bringing up social programs like Social Security as a way to prevent this fiscal cliff thing from happening. And it's easy to do the blame game and, you know, blame, like, poor, you know, the elderly, orphan children. When the problem's, like, glaring you in the face, all you got to do is end all these wars, you know, like Obama said he'd do. And maybe defund the Drug Enforcement Agency. That's trim a little fat. Another thing you could do is you could deny our the politicians extended terms, you know, if they can't come up with a balanced budget. Say you can't run again. And then, I don't know, why don't they just print some more money? That seems to be what they do anytime we run into an economic crisis, and then we can own the private banks that run the so-called Federal Reserve. We could owe them more. That's why we have Social Security numbers, so that we can be indebted to the Rothschilds and all those other bankers. And what about those Wall Street bankers we bailed out? Can't they just pay back what we gave them? All right, that's all I got to say. I'm out.
Thanks, Romeo. Let's go to Jason with another question about options. Jason in Albuquerque, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. I'm 25 years old, and I realize that past generations, before me were promised Social Security. And for that, I understand, but I'm wondering, with all the incompetence and mismanagement that's associated with typical programs that the government puts out, I'm wondering if it seemed like a viable option in the future for generations like myself later in time to opt out of Social Security to save our own money for ourselves.
Well, I think correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but the idea, as you explained, Social Security is pay as you go. So people who are paying into the system now are paying for the benefits of people who are retired now. So opting out as a young person wouldn't be an option. But could you opt out as a retired person and say, hey, I took care of myself? I mean, I paid into the system, but I also took care of myself above and beyond that. Could you opt out of receiving your benefits after you retired?
I guess in theory you could do that. I'm not sure if people are going to line up to do that particular thing. But I do think that the point is a good one, a valid one, in that we as young people, and I'm 37 years old, I would like to count myself among the young, but we could get a much better rate of return under a reformed Social Security system. I would gladly give up every penny I've paid into Social Security over the 15 or so years that I've been in the workforce for the privilege of investing my money in a way that would derive a greater return. Because that's really, and I know we're talking fiscal cliff, we're talking immediate here and now, but that's really the problem with Social Security, is that the rate of return for the young person is minimal, aside from the fact that because of the baby boom and demographics, the number of people paying in is certainly less than it was when it was set up. So that's a whole nother show. I know Elaine really is trying to stay on topic here, but maybe we can have that conversation in some future time.
Let's take another call. Coffee in Albuquerque. Good morning, Coffee. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. My point is this. There's been a lot of talk about the federal government having grown from about 18% to something like 21 to 23%, depending on who you read, of the GDP.
Meaning the federal government is that percentage of the gross domestic product?
Exactly. Has grown as a proportion of the GDP. But that's not completely correct. Some spending has increased, like stimulus and two wars. But it's also the case that as the private sector sank, an unchanging federal budget would automatically be a bigger percentage. If we shrank that because we think it should still match 18%, that would have made the recession worse, not better, and increased unemployment because the total economy would have shrank by that much more. That was my whole point.
Thanks, Coffee. Paul, did you have a thought about that?
Well, I would say that the caller makes a valid point, but if the federal government had grown at the rate of inflation since Clinton's last budget, we'd be spending $2.3 trillion today, not the 3.6 that we are, and we'd actually be collecting $2.5 trillion in revenues for a nice $200 billion surplus.
But does a comparison to inflation relate to the size of the private sector and the government, as Coffee was, I mean, it sounds like that's apples and he was talking about oranges.
Well, the per capita, per GDP does include, it is impacted by the overall national product. But if you just take into account inflation, it illustrates the fact that this is a spending-driven problem that we're dealing with, not a lack of revenue problem or any of those kinds of things. So that's the real point.
Jerry?
With the government giving up $1.2 trillion on tax cuts for the top 2%, I beg to differ. I think it's certainly in part a revenue problem, and also there's a basic philosophical difference between Paul and I, and I would say that the federal government had to spend more; it was morally obligated to spend more in the course of the recession, and the recession was caused by the housing bubble and the irresponsible antics of the financial sector. So the government had a step in to keep unemployment from going much, much higher. Most analysts think that despite the derision that Paul expressed toward the stimulus program, most economists think that stimulus kept the unemployment rate from going up another 3 to 5%. So, 9% is bad enough, but 12 or 14 would be much, much worse. So we had to do that. The spending is coming down. The stimulus has worked its way through the system, and in New Mexico, what's happening is that because the stimulus to the education sector, for instance, has worked its way through, we've got declines in in state and local education employment. So larger class sizes and more and more tuition increases.
Chris Hellman, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, just to throw another number into the mix is
another number.
It's interesting to note that revenues, federal revenues, right now are at the lowest point they've been in almost 50 years, and that is a reflection less of the tax code than it is of the strength of our overall economy. When people are working, they pay taxes, and so I think that, you know, that's an important component of the discussion, and one that Jerry has alluded to a couple of times. So to say that this is entirely a spending driven problem, I think doesn't really cover all the numbers that are out there. Clearly, at least to my mind, revenues are a portion of the discussion.
But if we enacted Jerry's preferred $1.2 trillion over 10-year program of increasing revenue from the wealthier taxpayers, that cures about 1 year's worth of the deficit, or 10% over that 10 years. So clearly more needs to be done to close that gap than just increasing the taxes on high-income taxpayers.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that absolutely. I mean, I think, as you know, as I've said a couple of different times, is that this is a bigger question than just spending cuts or just tax increases. It's about revisiting in a meaningful and thoughtful way how we're going to continue to pay for the things we want the government to provide for us.
Jerry, what do you think? What would you like to see if in that case that the taxes letting the tax cuts expire for wealthier Americans, if that amount is really 10% of the kind of larger problem that we're talking about here, where else would money come from in your idea?
Well, the analysis that I've seen from the Congressional Budget Office and other sources say that ending the tax cuts on the top 2% would yield $1.2 trillion. And in order to get the debt-to-GDP ratio to 70%, we would need another $800 billion. So $2 trillion in tax cuts all together. And one of the ways that we could address this is in the prescription drug program under Medicare. The initial program is passed under the Bush administration, forbade the federal government from negotiating with the drug companies for prices on prescription drugs under Part D of Medicare. That could, I think that if we're interested in reducing the deficit in a reasonable way, some of that should come from the patent monopolies of the drug companies.
Chris, are there analyses that show that kind of money, $800 billion, could be found by lowering the cost of drugs and negotiating prices with pharmaceutical companies?
I was actually unaware of that provision of the drug law. I'm really intrigued by that. I'm going to have to go back and find out more about that. Maybe Jerry and I can have a conversation on the side afterwards. But I'm sure that there are things like that can be done that will generate, you know, substantial amounts of revenue. I mean, one of the things that Jerry alluded to, or one of the callers alluded to, was, you know, we're lucky. Sequestration, for instance, is going to cut about $110 billion out of next year's the 2013 fiscal budget. That just happens to be almost exactly dollar for dollar what we paid for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan this year. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get about this, and that's why I keep coming back to this idea that, you know, we need to do something in the short term about the cliff, but this is really a discussion about, you know, a broader series of options about what, you know, how we're going to pay for what the government and what the government is going to do for us.
Paul, briefly, your last comments, and then before we end, I have one yes or no question that I want to answer from each of you from. But Paul, your last comments.
Well, Jerry brings up a point, and that is that we haven't addressed a lot of different smaller provisions for reducing spending. But if we did eliminate the entire military, all spending, including veterans, we would still have a significant budget deficit annually. So we have to take this approach all over the budget and be aggressive.
All right. So my question for all three of you is, are we going to go over the fiscal cliff? Paul?
Yes.
Jerry?
I don't believe so. I think reason will prevail.
No. Chris?
Maybe.
Maybe. A yes, no, and a maybe. All right. Thanks to you all for joining us this morning. Chris Hellman is with the National Priorities Project. Paul Gessing is with the Rio Grande Foundation. Jerry Bradley is with New Mexico Voices for Children. If you missed part of this program, you'll be able to find the audio posted online shortly after the end of the show at KUNM.org. You can also post your comments. You can send emails. You can send emails to callinshow@kunm.org. And next week, we'll hear from some authors talking about food and identity and where to eat great stuff in New Mexico. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us.